This episode features discussion of kidnapping and extreme violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
49-year-old Virginia Piper never expected to find herself at gunpoint.
Least of all in her own home, where she didn't even bother locking the doors at night. But now she found herself staring down the barrels of four guns.
Ever the consummate hostess, she tried to play it cool. After all, she's Ginny Piper. She can talk to anyone, even burglars.
Though, admittedly, two large, nervous men waving guns were not ideal house guests.
They asked her where her husband was, and she admitted he was at work. At this, the two men grew enraged, but Ginny didn't react.
She simply smiled, swallowing her fear, hoping to put them at ease. She had one priority, to get herself and her house staff through this alive.
She invited the men to rifle through her jewelry and assured them they were welcome to anything in the house.
She wasn't expecting them to take that literally. One of the men withdrew a pair of handcuffs as his partner aimed his gun.
"Mrs. Piper," he said, "you're going with us."
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of 49-year-old socialite Virginia Piper from her home outside Minneapolis, Minnesota in 1972.
On the afternoon of July 27th, Ginny, as she was known, was working in her garden when two masked gunmen kidnapped her. In the ensuing 48 hours, her family and the FBI tried frantically to follow the kidnappers' demands and pay the ransom, hoping against hope that she'd survive.
This week, we'll look at Virginia Piper and her family, the events surrounding her abduction, and the initial response of her family, the FBI, and the public.
Next week, we'll track how her husband, Bobby Piper, and the FBI worked to satisfy the detailed ransom demands as Ginny fought to survive captivity. We'll also delve into the psychology of a tense hostage situation and look at how this became one of the most unusual kidnappings in U.S. history.
In 1968, 4 years before Ginny Piper was taken, a terrorist group known as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or the PFLP, hijacked several airplanes flying around Europe and the Middle East. They held crew and passengers hostage in the hopes of getting both attention for the Palestinian plight and the release of hundreds of their fellow fighters.
This event inspired a pandemic of kidnappings worldwide, as desperate people seeking money, freedom, attention, or even transportation to another country realized they could capture the world's attention by putting other people's lives at risk.
From there, kidnappings and hijackings filled the news on a seemingly nightly basis. D.B. Cooper, Patty Hearst, the October crisis in Quebec, the Norrmalmstorg robbery in Sweden, to name but a few.
In fact, it became so common for planes to be hijacked and rerouted to Cuba that airlines began equipping each plane with flight paths to Havana in the likelihood they would eventually need them.
In the early 1970s, anyone in a position of money or power knew they were a potential target. And yet, the Piper family seemed blissfully unaware that their wealthy socialite status put them in the line of fire. After all, They lived in Minnesota. Things like that just didn't happen there.
Until they did. No one actually knows who kidnapped Virginia Piper. Shortly before the statute of limitations on the case ran out, the FBI charged two men with the crime, Kenneth Callahan and Don Larson, but they were ultimately exonerated.
And in many ways, they were never very good suspects, with the only piece of evidence against them seemingly doctored by the FBI to frame them.
What we do know is there were at least two men involved, and that they were both hefty, middle-aged guys who seemed to be of a working-class background, judging from their manner of speaking.
During her capture, Ginny asked one of her captors questions about himself and the plan, and she said he volunteered some information, but admittedly she wasn't sure if anything he told her was true.
What he told her painted a picture of a man who wasn't a career criminal, who probably didn't even have a criminal record, though he likely had friends who did. He also made it seem like there was a mastermind behind the whole operation, controlling every moving part to keep them from getting caught, ideally without anyone getting hurt.
But whatever their reasons, one thing is certain. These were people who knew the Piper family and their dealings intimately. Someone who felt wronged by the wealthy family and was eager to settle the score.
And unfortunately for Ginny, they weren't picky about which Piper they took.
Virginia Piper was born on November 24, 1922, the second of five glamorous sisters from a well-to-do Minneapolis family. While the sisters were regular fixtures on the Minneapolis-St. Paul social scene, they didn't seek attention. They were so-called accomplished young women of the interwar period, who played musical instruments, rode horses, played upper-class sports, and danced. Although they also went to public high schools and were raised to believe that giving back to their community was the most important thing they could do after getting married.
Even among this group, Virginia always stood out. She was friendly and outgoing, happy to talk to anyone and share her opinions. She had a magnetic quality. After being chosen as homecoming queen at her high school, she went to a two-year women's college in Massachusetts on a music scholarship in 1940. And when she returned to Minnesota 2 years later at age 19, she married 24-year-old Harry Piper, whom everyone called Bobby.
Bobby, a Princeton graduate also from Minneapolis, seemed in many ways to be Ginny's antithesis. Quiet and reserved. He avoided public attention and barely shared his emotions and personal thoughts with even his closest friends. After serving in the Army Air Corps in World War II, he returned home in 1946 to join his father's stock brokerage, Piper, Jaffrey, and Hopwood, colloquially known as Piper Jaffrey. When his father retired, Bobby became CEO of Piper Jaffrey and grew it into a major investment firm.
But Ginny and Bobby were a team. She was a crucial part of the landscape at Piper Jaffrey, and in addition to advising Bobby on business matters, often accompanied him on business trips. While she didn't have a job, she joined the board of nearby Northwestern Hospital, to which she dedicated a tremendous amount of time and energy.
But despite Ginny's outgoing nature and dozens of close friends, she enjoyed her privacy. She didn't want to be in the public eye any more than her husband did. Gossip and tabloids were for celebrities, athletes, and public figures, not for private citizens, however wealthy or philanthropic.
So they bought a 5-bedroom house on 7.5 acres of land in the quiet suburb of Orono, just outside the Twin Cities. There they raised their 3 sons, Harry, Tad, and David.
Ginny loved working in her garden, and while many of their wealthier neighbors hired full-time staff, the Pipers never did. They weren't ostentatious people, and they didn't even think of themselves as especially wealthy, though they did consider it important to give what money they did have back to their community.
It never occurred to them that the comfortable life they were developing would one day make them a target.
Next, we'll see how Ginny went from housewife to hostage.
Now, back to the story.
By the time the summer of 1972 rolled around, Bobby and Ginny Piper were a well-established part of the Minneapolis-St. Paul gentry. The 49-year-old Ginny would be called a socialite, serving on the hospital board and regularly hosting events. Now 54 years old, Bobby had a seat on the New York Stock Exchange Board of Governors in addition to heading Piper Jaffray.
The Pipers were known for having an open-door policy at their house in the well-to-do suburb of Orono. The front door was rarely locked, as the neighborhood was generally considered safe, and friends and relatives were constantly dropping by for coffee, a cigarette, or one of Ginny's famous cocktails.
The most regular visitors were Ginny's sisters and their families, all of whom lived in the area. Her four sisters, Charlotte, Carol, Dana, and Gretchen, were all active in the Minneapolis social scene, though it was Ginny and Charlotte, known as Shy, around whom the family congregated.
And then there were the Pipers' three sons. In 1972, the oldest, 28-year-old Harry C. Piper III, held a degree in economics from Harvard. He had also completed law school at Stanford before taking a job in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. He and his wife, Valerie, had recently decided to move back to Minneapolis with their young son. Harry had spent the last several months studying for the Minnesota Bar, which he took that summer.
While Harry was the oldest Piper son and felt a tremendous amount of pressure from his parents, he was also quite different from them and always felt a bit removed, especially from his father.
A young man in the 60s and 70s, he was a progressive Democrat, while his parents were traditional Republicans. He also didn't share his parents' desire for privacy. While in his 20s and 30s, he ran a friend's campaign for state office and considered running for Congress himself. He would later go on to become a part-time journalist and creative writer, unafraid of putting himself out there.
That summer was also the first in a while that Ginny had all her sons back in Minneapolis. Their youngest, David, age 19, with whom Ginny was especially close, had just finished his freshman year at Whittier College in Los Angeles. He was already planning to go to law school, like his brother, but in the meantime, he was working a summer job as a lifeguard and enjoying the break from school.
Finally, the Pipers' 25-year-old middle son, Addison, known as Tad, had recently moved in along with his wife Louise, whom everyone called Weezer, and their two young children. Tad had also studied economics in undergrad, though at Williams College in Massachusetts. He followed in his brother's footsteps by going to Stanford for his MBA. He promptly went into finance, joining Piper Jaffray and settling into life in Minneapolis.
That summer, Tad and Weezer were remodeling her childhood home, which they'd recently bought from her parents. In the meantime, it made perfect sense to stay at Tad's parents' five-bedroom house in Orono. They already spent so much time there anyway.
For Ginny, it was a dream to be able to have her family all around her. The house was always lively and fun. Friends and relatives dropping by only added to the convivial atmosphere. David going away to college had been harder on Ginny than she'd anticipated. While she'd always had plenty of her own activities going on, having her youngest child leave the nest had prompted a lot of self-reflection.
Of course, her husband Bobby would never let on if he had felt the same crisis. But around the same time, he enrolled at Union Theological Seminary in nearby New Brighton. He had no intention of becoming a minister, but he'd always been interested in philosophy and theology and wanted a chance to explore his interest further. If Ginny thought he was grappling with middle age and his kids growing up, she didn't let on.
She was relieved, though, that he didn't want to be a minister. She had never been religious, and this was one area where they couldn't connect. In fact, she found herself somewhat resenting his dedication to the course. He threw himself into his studies with the same all-consuming dedication that he did all his work and interests, from golf to the office to the exclusion of their family life.
Ginny resented how he prioritized his interests over her, leaving her to manage everything else in their lives, from the kids to the house to their social obligations. She tried to be a good wife, but she had a strong, forceful personality, and suppressing her feelings didn't come naturally.
When she finally tried to talk to Bobby about it, he didn't seem to understand or even want to. Of course she knew he loved her, but he didn't get that she also wanted to be able to explore her own goals and interests without having to always subsume her personality to his.
Ginny reached her breaking point not long before the summer of 1972. Their son Harry later told journalist William Swanson that his mother threatened to leave his father. In the heat of the moment, she went so far as to pack her bags and drive away, showing Bobby just how serious she was.
Ginny came back after cooling off, and the two of them tried to work it out. But Ginny's resentment still simmered beneath the surface. Bobby tried to be more thoughtful, but he was traditional in his views of marriage, expecting her to manage the bulk of family life while he was free to pursue his own work and interests. Ginny knew that he was never really going to change his stripes and that she would never be a priority in the relationship.
But that summer, Bobby's classes and studying didn't bother her quite as much as usual, since she had so many kids and grandkids around the house.
As the summer wore on, Ginny settled into a nice routine. The extended family often had breakfast together, and Ginny enjoyed spending mornings playing with her two young grandsons.
She worked in her garden a lot and had friends over for drinks and lunch. She and her sisters dropped in on one another for catch-ups and coffee. She went to charity events, hosted dinner parties, and spent a lot of time working at the hospital.
She didn't mind that Bobby had to go to New York for meetings every few weeks. In fact, she even chose not to go with him because there was so much going on in Minneapolis. All in all, it was a good summer.
Thursday, July 27th, 1972, started like any other Thursday. After Bobby left for work, Ginny's two cleaning ladies, Bernice Bechtold and Vernetta Zimmerman, arrived for their weekly visit. Ginny went to her hair and nails appointment in the nearby town of Wayzata, then returned home for her standard peanut butter sandwich lunch. She had a board meeting later in the day at Northwestern Hospital, but until then, her plan was to work in her beloved garden.
It was a warm, languid summer afternoon, and the glamorous Twin Cities socialite was relaxed as she plucked dead flowers out of her garden, which made it all the more startling when shortly after 1 o'clock, Bernice hurried out the back door, flustered and upset. Ginny had no idea what was going on, but Bernice's demeanor scared her. Had something happened to one of her kids or grandkids? She hurried inside.
As soon as she stepped inside, she saw two large, heavy-set men, identically dressed in dark clothes, their heads covered with strange black and red masks, and they each carried two guns.
One of them had a gun trained on Vernetta, the other cleaning lady, and the other walked towards Ginny, guns out.
He ordered her to get Bernice back inside. Ginny kept her cool, calling out the door to Bernice, telling her it was okay. But when Bernice came back inside, the men sat her and Vernetta on dining room chairs and taped them down with clear packing tape. Ginny watched helplessly.
Then the men turned to her. They demanded to know if she was Mrs. Piper, which she confirmed. One of them asked, "Where's your old man?" She told them he was at the office.
Ginny wasn't sure why they'd expect Bobby to be home. Some Thursday afternoons, he'd go to New York for meetings or to the United Theological Seminary for his theology classes, but he was always out and about town. Bobby's absence seemed to upset the men. One of them ranted his frustration, blaming the mistake on someone called Chino.
Then they turned back to Ginny and demanded to know where the safe was. The Pipers didn't have a safe, but Ginny, worried that the invaders would be even angrier at that information, told them she had a few pieces of jewelry upstairs that they could have.
The masked men weren't interested. Instead, they told her, "No, Mrs. Piper, you're going with us." They handcuffed her and marched her out the front door, the barrel of a gun pressing into her back.
As they passed her purse, the man pushing her forward rifled through and took the $6 bills in her wallet. The other man placed a white envelope labeled Family atop the desk next to the living room door.
As they left the house, they told Bernice and Vernetta to stay where they were and not to call anyone.
The men marched Ginny across the driveway to a green two-door car. It took them a minute to figure out how to flip the passenger seat forward to allow Ginny to climb in the back seat.
Before they drove off, one of the men gave Ginny a pillowcase, one of her own pillowcases. Her stomach churned as she realized that before making themselves known, they'd gone into her bedroom.
The man told her to put the pillowcase over her head and to lie down on the back seat. She didn't dare disobey him. According to a hostage negotiation specialist at UK firm Athena Intelligence, this is the right approach to being kidnapped. They explain that a hostage's best chance of survival is to be passive and compliant, though not submissive or weak. Ginny's innate skills as a people person helped her recognize from the beginning that she shouldn't antagonize her kidnappers, lest she anger them or give them a reason to hurt her.
Ginny felt the car pull away from the house, turn right at the end of the long driveway, and they were off. She tried to follow the turns and keep track of where they were going or what roads they were on based on the car's speed, but she quickly lost track of where they were.
The men barely spoke, instead listening to what she assumed was a police radio, which she could barely hear. What the men did say referred to police cars and roadblocks. When one of them started smoking, Ginny realized how many hours it had been since her last cigarette and wished she could ask for one.
Finally, the car picked up speed and Ginny realized they were on a highway, though she had no idea what direction they were going. Nor did she have any idea how long it had been since they left the house.
All she could do was assume that Bernice and Vernetta had managed to raise the alarm and hope that Bobby and the rest of her family had started looking for her. She just hoped she wasn't too lost to be found.
Next, we'll follow the first few hours of Ginny's captivity. Now back to the story.
On July 27, 1972, 49-year-old Virginia Piper's life changed in an instant. One moment, the Minneapolis socialite had been gardening. The next, she'd been marched out of her house at gunpoint.
And now, she was lying in the back seat of a car, a pillowcase over her head, as her kidnappers drove her somewhere. She hoped desperately that the two cleaning ladies the kidnappers had tied up in her house had managed to raise the alarm.
Almost as soon as they heard the kidnappers' car pull away, Bernice and Vernetta started trying to escape. The men hadn't taped them up very well, and Bernice was able to pull her arms free and help Vernetta do the same. Terrified that perhaps the men's accomplices were monitoring the phones or the house, the two women jumped into Vernetta's car to go for help.
They drove to Ginny's sister's house, which wasn't far away. The two women also cleaned house once a week for Ginny's sister, Shy Morrison, so they knew and trusted her.
Shy was the one who raised the alarm. First, she called the Hennepin County Sheriff and the Wayzata Police. Then she called Bobby at his office. As soon as he had all the details, he called the local FBI office and then headed home to meet them and the police.
The FBI's jurisdiction in this case was technically questionable. A kidnapping only becomes a federal crime if the hostage is taken across state lines. However, with the large number of kidnappings that had been happening in recent years, the FBI had become the de facto authority on handling kidnappings, and their experience suggested that kidnappers often do take their hostages to other states.
Plus, kidnappings require a rapid response for the best chance of finding the victim. Wasting time deciding jurisdiction would be in no one's best interest, which meant that the FBI essentially ran cases from the beginning.
After notifying the FBI, Bobby headed straight home to join the law enforcement officials and get straight to work. The police set up a perimeter around the Piper's property, as well as checkpoints throughout the area. When Bobby arrived home at around 1:45 p.m., they finally found the white envelope the kidnappers left, with the ransom note inside.
In the meantime, it took a while to track down the Piper's three sons. Tad was at work at Piper Jaffrey, though he actually learned of his mother's abduction from his father's secretary. He was immediately concerned about his wife, Weezer, and their two small children, who would normally have been at his parents' house that day. By chance, Weezer had taken the kids over to their new house to check up on the remodeling, thus missing the kidnapping entirely.
The youngest Piper son, David, had spent the morning working as a lifeguard. After that, he went to the DMV to get a motorcycle learner's permit. He only learned of his mother's abduction around 3 p.m. while he was driving home when a radio station broadcast an emergency bulletin. Reality sank in as he pulled into the driveway and saw all the cop cars.
The oldest son, Harry, was on a fly fishing trip in Montana. No one had any way of reaching him. His wife and their son huddled with the rest of the extended family and hoped that he was okay.
The ransom note was typed on a sheet of notebook paper, a surprisingly long and detailed all-caps missive that the FBI felt indicated a high degree of competence and planning on the part of the kidnappers.
It started by stating that the ransom amount was $1 million. Adjusted for inflation, that would be over $6 million today. According to the FBI agents, this was the largest ransom demand ever made in the U.S. up to this point. The note went on to specify that the ransom money must consist entirely of used $20 bills, divided into four separately wrapped packages of $250,000 each.
Those four packages were to be put into a large drawstring, canvas, or duck bag in a brown or olive color. And, the note stressed, the money and bag would be checked for tracking devices, markings, radioactivity, and any other possible ways for the authorities to locate or trick the ransomers. If anything was found, the hostage would not be returned.
The money would have to be delivered tomorrow night by someone closely associated with the Piper Jaffrey firm. The kidnapper would verify his or her relationship with the company before accepting the money.
The note continued with a series of very detailed instructions as to how the delivery must take place, including that the deliverer's car must be registered to their home address, that the money must be in the car's trunk, that the car must have a full tank of gas, and that the deliverer must carry at least $200 on him, as well as at least five dimes.
All of this would have to be prepared by 9:30 p.m. tomorrow night, when instructions for the delivery would arrive at the Piper's house. After that, the person making the delivery would need to set out immediately.
The kidnappers warned that police radio frequencies would be monitored, and if they suspected any foul play, they wouldn't complete the handover.
In fact, if anything throughout the intricate delivery process deviated from their instructions, not only would the handoff not be completed, but the kidnappers would not be in touch again. Should the delivery be completed as described, the person making the delivery would be safe.
If all went according to plan, they promised the safe release of the prisoner at 6 a.m. the following morning.
Both Bobby and the FBI agents recognized the sophistication of the instructions in the note. Clearly, the kidnappers were familiar with the firm of Piper Jaffrey and had specifically targeted the family. They may have originally hoped to kidnap Bobby, but the lack of names in the note suggested they were prepared for an alternate hostage if need be.
The FBI agents on the scene were concerned. They felt sure they were dealing with professionals. Hardened criminals whom they needed to catch and stop, lest they strike again.
Despite being a pretty stoic man, Bobby was scared. He didn't have $1 million. Despite his job in finance, the Pipers weren't especially wealthy. And though he tried not to show it, the clinical precision of the kidnappers' demands sent a chill down his spine. But there was no way he was going to let them kill Ginny. So he decided right then that he would figure out a way to follow the instructions to the letter, if that's what it took to get his wife back.
The FBI agents tried to explain to him that catching the kidnappers was just as important as rescuing Ginny, but Bobby wouldn't hear it. He wouldn't do anything to jeopardize Ginny's safety, even if that meant losing money he didn't even have and letting the kidnappers go free.
This frustrated the FBI agents, who wanted to send their own men to do the drop-off or at least lay a trap for whoever picked up the money. But they knew that if they pushed Bobby too hard, it could backfire. Their jurisdiction over the case was tenuous, with no one actually knowing if the kidnapping was a federal crime, and they didn't want to risk getting pushed off it. The agents decided to choose their battles.
Meanwhile, Ginny and her kidnappers continued their drive. Lying handcuffed in the back seat, a pillowcase over her head, she had no idea where they were or how long they'd been driving.
She was getting stiff and asked for permission to roll over, which one of the men agreed to. If only she could ask for a cigarette, too.
After a while, one of the men told her to sit up. They had to make a tape recording for her husband, he explained, telling her what to say. He made her repeat it back to him before sticking a small microphone under the pillowcase for her to speak into.
She told Bobby that she was fine and that the men were taking good care of her, and that he needed to follow their instructions. And then she laid out the specific instructions the man had given her for what Bobby should do tomorrow when he heard the recording. She repeated them once again for good measure.
When she finished, the men told her to lie back down, and the drive continued.
Ginny didn't really know what to do. There was no way she could escape. The best she could hope for was that if she followed their instructions, she'd be okay, and hopefully Bobby would follow whatever ransom instructions they'd left.
She also hoped that the ransom wasn't too big. Thinking of their savings account, she figured Bobby wouldn't be able to find more than $50,000 or so. Of course, Ginny had no idea just how much more than that they'd asked for.
She wasn't really afraid, though. The men hadn't hurt her at all and hadn't seemed cruel.
But then, after what felt like hours, the car slowed and turned off the road. It stopped, and the wheels seemed to spin as if the car was stuck, possibly in mud. Ginny's head raced with possibilities of where they might be. A farm? Or the middle of nowhere? Somewhere no one would hear her scream, that's for sure.
The men pulled her out of the back seat by her arms, the pillowcase still over her head.
She stepped into wet grass that went up past her ankles. It was raining lightly. Ginny started to shiver.
One of the men led her forward, up a hill, through the wet grass. She slipped in what felt like mud, her garden sandals unable to get traction. As night fell, the light leaking through her pillowcase seemed to fade, and she felt far colder than she had before.
Ginny had lost all sense of time. How long it had been since the gunmen showed up at her house? Did they drive around in circles, or were they hundreds of miles from Minneapolis?
Even now, the walk seemed to stretch on, though she felt they couldn't actually be going that far.
Where were these men taking her? To their boss, some criminal mastermind? To a hideout? To her death?
Wordlessly, she trudged onwards, tepidly trusting the man leading her, although to what ends, she did not know. Next week on Hostage, we'll follow Ginny as she awaits her fate, trapped in the wilds of Minnesota with one of her kidnappers. We'll also track the lengths to which Bobby went in order to satisfy the kidnappers' demands.
And we'll take a quick look at how the kidnappers somehow managed to get away with the kidnapping.
You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.